teachings on the foundations of mindfulness, I decided that it might be useful, as I was saying earlier, to integrate that with some introductory remarks on the nature of the Buddha's teachings. Sort of what, where they came from, what was on his mind, why he decided to offer this realm of teaching, and why it's kind of sort of taken hold over the last 2.5 millennia. So the first, the core of the Buddha's teachings are what are traditionally referred to as the Four Noble Truths, and then the Eightfold Path. And so in the course of talking about what our experience was in sitting, we'll be kind of all integrated with some of this other material. Buddha was born to a wealthy household who at a certain age, about 29, I think, decided to renounce the life of leisure and become a renunciate and a spiritual seeker instead. He spent the next 6 years or so mostly in reclusive forest environments, sitting with various different meditation teachers who were regarded at the time in northeastern India where he lived as being sort of masters of their respective disciplines. And he learned a variety of disciplines, learned very deep concentration, learned this mindfulness meditation practice and some others, but still ultimately at the end found himself not much closer to achieving his goal, which was to discover why there is suffering in the world and how it might be brought to an end. And so after learning everything he could from all these other teachers, he basically decided to follow at a deeper level the same advice that he gave to his earlier followers, which was the same advice that Joseph got from Manindra, which was the same advice I shared this evening, which is, let's just sit and have a look at the mind and see what happens. This first noble truth, as he discovered it when he sat and looked at the mind, which is to say, which was, you know, it occurred to him, he discovered as he sat that things aren't always happy in Mr. Buddha's neighborhood. That their difficulties arose in the mind. Difficulties that seem to have to do with the states of mind that arose. Okay. States of mind of anger and aggression and fear and anxiety. States of mind of craving and clinging. Okay. The arising of factors in the mind that he did not really particularly want to pay attention to. And so the first of these observations that he made in laying out his teachings was that suffering happens. Okay. That there are many different kinds of suffering that occur out there in the world and that occur inside. Some of those forms of suffering are unsatisfactoriness or distress. Have to do simply with the fact that we're in a physical body that is capable of experiencing pleasure and the delights of the world, and coming into fulfillment as living beings on this beautiful earth, but that it is also subject to a lot of stress, a lot of unsatisfactoriness, a lot of uncomfortableness. Some of which just comes along with having a nervous system that's trying to tell us when things go wrong, when there's physical pain, that have to do with infirmity or injury, that have to do with aging, and that have to do with the fact that the statistics look pretty grim when it comes to what happens at the end of life, which is that it ends. We die. So, of these various kinds of suffering, some of them he said, you know, just come with the territory. You know, all compounded things, as it is said, all the everything that's made up of something else, it arises, it changes, and it passes away, including us. You know, we are compounded things. So that's just sort of a fact of nature. The kind of distress that he was talking about had more to do with the inability of the mind to accept this, that this is so. So the existence of suffering, of various kinds of suffering, the kind of suffering that he sort of zeroed in on, okay, was the form of suffering that he saw arising not just from the fact that we are in the body, but the kind of suffering that arises from mental activity itself. So suffering exists. Second noble truth, the cause of suffering. What causes the mind? Okay, and here I'm using, I'll be using the word mind in several different ways. Mind, capital M, is sort of the totality of our capacity for awareness and for attentiveness, okay, of all that we experience. Okay. I'm also going to be talking about discursive mind. Discursive mind is something else. It's one of the functions that's performed by mind at large. Okay. Discursive mind is the storytelling mind. It's the mind that tries to make sense of all the incoming sensory data, that weaves a story about who we are, or who we think we are, who we think other people are, how the world works. How to interpret the data that come in. So, in modern neuroscience terms, one way of understanding what it was the Buddha was trying to get at in terms of the origins of suffering, the word he used was tanha, or craving, but basically what he was trying to get at was all the different ways that the discursive mind wants things to be different from how they are. All the ways that the discursive mind judges what's going on around us, as well as judging ourselves, to in some way be unsatisfactory, in need of change. The way that's spoken about in contemporary terms is this. The reason that we're here as a species, some crucial survival level hardwiring, has trained us and many other organisms in the world as well, in fact most of them, most sentient beings, okay, to be able to quickly scan our environment and to categorize or to sort all the sensory inputs that come our way. Okay. In order for us to be able to survive as species and as individuals, the mind has to be very quickly able to discern what is an opportunity, that is, what is something we need to move towards in order to satisfy basic needs, to nourish ourselves, to hydrate ourselves, to find shelter, to find clothing, to find all the means of sustenance so we can survive, and more. So seeking out the positive, okay? Seeking sense gratification. The senses are organized and designed the way they are in order to help us fulfill those basic needs. Second major function is to be able to discern threats in the environment and to avoid them. Okay. Seeking opportunities, avoiding threats. And then, you know, as William James said, you know, my experience is what I agree to attend to, because there are literally millions of sensory inputs that are headed my direction all the time. Much more information than I have the capacity to make sense of. And so what I do is, what the mind does as a result, is that it tends to filter out everything that does not have to do with either satisfying a need or avoiding a threat. Okay. So, when I was suggesting as we sat that in addition to simply noting what it feels like to be in the body and being mindful of the breathing, staying grounded in the body in the moment and whatnot, you know, I also suggested that as we sat that you kind of looked at how the mind was reacting to whatever it is you're experiencing. whether it was a sensation in the body, a body posture, whatnot, whether it was really paying attention to the breathing for maybe the first time or the first time in a long time, and finding that very experience to be kind of calming and pleasant. Okay, maybe you're into jazz, a pretty good band, you know, so you may have been experiencing pleasant sensations from listening to the music. Unless, of course, you really don't like jazz, or you're a jazz player, and you could tell all the times they weren't quite getting it, you know, in which case you may have found it to be unpleasant. You may have come here expecting a calm, peaceful, quiet evening together. And so the very fact that there was so much racket was kind of a bummer. You felt a little disappointed, you know. I didn't get my donations worth, right? Because there's noisy. And that is, in fact, that's the second foundation of mindfulness. It's mindfulness of the mind's tendency to judge everything we experience as being pleasant or unpleasant or neutral. So I decided to kind of go ahead and fast forward to that aspect of it as well, so we can incorporate it into the experience of our time here together this evening. Okay. So, the actual reality of suffering and the means by which the discursive mind kind of adds something to that by the judging factor of like it, don't like it, don't care. Okay. So that's the first two noble truths. The third one is that suffering can actually be brought to an end. And the fourth is the means for doing it, which we'll get to in a few minutes here. So the reality of suffering, the fact that much of this suffering is actually generated by mind itself. Okay. What, in the view of many, has happened, and certainly although the Buddha didn't speak in terms of neuroscience exactly, was that, you know, we have these basic tendencies toward, you know, seeking out the pleasant, avoiding the unpleasant, and ignoring everything else. Once those basic functions have been performed, however, over time, we have developed the capacity to massively amplify those tendencies of mind, with the effect that sometimes seeking out the pleasant goes far beyond just meeting basic needs. And it can kind of morph into an obsessive, incessant desire, unquenchable desire, whether it's for sense gratification or material rewards or status in society, a sense of never having enough, always wanting more, okay, of craving taken to an unwholesome extreme. The Middle German and Old French origins of the word evil translate as beyond reasonable bounds, exceeding due measure. So the sense of what I've got is never enough, always needing more and more and more and more. Greed. Okay. That's the seeking out of opportunity taken to the unreasonable extreme. The sense of needing to guard oneself against threats, okay, discern threats and avoid them, taken to its extreme, can begin to manifest as a mind state that tends to be either angry at or somewhat afraid of or anxious about many stimuli in the environment don't actually necessarily present a threat. Okay. A mind state of aversion can be aversion to other people, aversion to aspects of the environment, aversion to political leaders that in your view are suffering from a rectal cranial inversion. It can be aversion to lots of things. It can take, and generally speaking, takes the form of either anger or fear, because they're actually two sides of the same coin. And then, of course, there are all these things in the environment, or all these things about ourselves that we really don't particularly care to know about. Okay. And so when you see the term ignorance in Buddhist texts, it can be helpful to emphasize the pronouncing of the word in a different way. So it's understood to be not just absence of knowledge, but an active desire to not know. Ignorance. Choosing to ignore, even if you're not fully aware that that's what you're doing. Okay. Those three tendencies of mind, the Buddha called the three poisons, or the three torments of the mind. Greed, hate, and delusion, and their extreme forms. When the mind is influenced or affected by one of these states of mind, attachment, aversion, or delusion, it can color the entire world. You know? In the Tibetan tradition, there's a certain set of doctrines or teachings that that are called Dzogchen. Okay, and it has to do with coming to be able to discern or comprehend the true nature of mind and the things that get in the way of our ability to see clearly. And the Dzogchen teachers have on their little tables, they always, one of the teaching objects that many of them have is a crystal. And the way they use that object in teaching is they say, you know, each of us, our consciousness is struck by or touched by this primordial pure light of the universe. This consciousness that's shared with all of us equally, you know, like the sun shining down, okay. And the crystal represents our individual consciousness, state of mind, our personality, okay. The functions of the discursive mind. The light strikes the crystal and gets refracted onto the environment. So like especially in the winter months, you know, when the sun's low, you hang a crystal in the south window and the sun shines on it, you can see the little rainbow particles, you know, on the walls all around the environment, okay. So in this teaching, just the same thing happens. The primordial light strikes our consciousness and it's refracted through our consciousness onto the environment around us. So the environment around us is kind of like a projection screen. Okay. So if the mind happens to be imbued with a strong sense of aversion, whether it takes the form of anger or fear or anxiety, frustration, you know, resentment, whatever, if that's the dominant mind state, that tends to be the way that we see the world around us. Okay. If the mind is imbued with a state of want, you know, of really needing something that you don't have, a strongly felt sense, the need to acquire, need to grasp, then you scan the environment, what's out there that's good for me, right? And then if you are, you know, not particularly interested in knowing what's going on, probably for good reasons, then the mind is imbued with a state of delusion, and there's a lot that you simply don't see when you look all around you. Okay. If the mind is imbued with one of those states, attachment, aversion, or delusion, and we speak or act based upon that state of mind, it tends to have an unwholesome effect. It tends to cause suffering for ourselves or for other beings. Okay. And since that's the case, it's really useful if you can be aware of the state of mind, of the state of the crystal, your consciousness, through which you're looking at the world at any given point in time. If you're not aware of the fact that the mind is this crystal and you're inside it, and you're within the state of attachment, you're within the state of aversion, you're within the state of delusion, then that's your reality. That's all you see. What we just did, believe it or not, was to start to practice spending a little bit of time outside the crystal. So that instead of only seeing the world through it, you're able to step aside just for a moment and see yourself seeing the world in that way. Okay? That's different. Because any moment that you're mindful that the mind is seeing the world through the eyes or through the view of attachment, aversion, and delusion, anytime you have that awareness in that particular moment, you're not seeing the world that way. What you're basically seeing is, as soon as you become aware that there is a state of aversion, or that there's a state of attachment, or that there's a state of delusion, in that moment of awareness, you're not in that state of mind anymore. Basically, because the mind can really only do one thing at a time. In that particular moment, what you're really doing is looking back and seeing the state of mind that you were inhabiting just the moment before. Which is not to say you won't fall right back into it, you know, get sucked right back into the crystal. Okay? But if you're doing this mindfulness practice, and that's why the Buddha suggested, you know, it's nice if you can go find some quiet place to do this, so you can really be aware, tune in to what's going on in the mind. But that's not so you can spend the rest of your life trying to, you know, stay muffled away under the covers. And it's so that we seek out the quiet times and the quiet places, whether it's here or at home in a place wherever we meditate, to train the mind so that when we're out in daily life, we can still be aware of how the mind is interacting. Okay. So that's the Buddha's teaching on the fact that suffering happens, where the suffering comes from. Okay. How might the suffering be brought to an end? Okay. There are practices that the Buddha, and this is, we're doing one of them here this evening, there are practices that can be used to train the mind first to recognize the greed and attachment when it arises, and to transmute it into generosity. That can recognize the anger and the aversion when they arise and transmute them into kindness, into open-heartedness. To recognize when you are inhabiting a deliberately deluded state, see it for what it is, and transmute the mind into a state of wisdom. Okay. The reason the Buddha offered these teachings is because he figured out how to do those things. And at first, after he figured that out, he said, far out, my suffering's at end. I think I'm just going to go sit on a log and, you know, enjoy the rest of my life. And then people came along and said, nah, no, no, you didn't do all that work for nothing. You know, you really need to do what you can to share that with other people who are seeking just like you are. And so that's when he finally decided that, yeah, I guess I better give this a shot. And his first few tries, you know, he really bombed. and it was kind of hard figuring out how to teach this stuff in a way that people could actually relate to. But this third teaching, you know, he says, well, you know, I really worked with this, and I actually did figure out a way to bring these forms of suffering that are created by mind to an end. And then the fourth noble truth is, here's how I did it. Okay. And he taught an eight-step program, okay, eightfold path. And the way that's depicted in Buddhist iconography is through this shape here. This icon is called a Dharma wheel. Wheel with eight spokes. Before we get off into this one, I would first like to spend a little time, if we could, for those who are comfortable to do so, to share a little bit about what the nature of your experience was as we sat together this evening. What literally happened for you in terms of what you experienced in the body, in terms of and your reactions to that, and to the experience of the body, your reactions to the sound. Please.
So, at first, for several minutes, I was actually enjoying the sense of just kind of riding on the sound.
Yeah.
And at one point, a particular song took me back to being a teenager, and I noticed I really had to maintain some control to keep from rocking on. But then that changed to this bigger perspective of everything that was going to come in time after that.
Right.
And and then also my life, and like looking back. And then my hips started hurting me. And I was like, so I tried to be equanimous with that, and it kind of slowed down.
So that was quite a journey through like it, don't care in the space of 35 minutes. Right. Thank you. Thank you for sharing that. Others experience, please.
So when I first heard the music, I was brought back kind of in a similar way to like a party my grandparents must have had when I was a child with that same type of music. And I pictured myself, you know, in that like loving environment of a young child with the grandparents around laughing and parents, you know, all having fun. It was like really, it was just so fun. And then I kind of got angry when I heard people like running and laughing and opening doors, you know. And then that kind of came up to me was when I read Joseph Goldstein's Insight Meditation book, and he talks about when he went to India on a meditation. I think he was going to be there for like a year, and he had picked this place that was supposed to be extremely peaceful, and he showed up, and it ends up being across the street from a school or a girls' camp or something that happened to be there for the summer, and how mad he was and frustrated, and then, you know, over some time, he just kind of accepted it, said, this is just the way it is, and I felt myself also getting to that place, like, sometimes, you know, this is what happens when you're trying to be quiet and focus and concentrate and meditate, but, you know, it's just the way it is, so.
Thank you. What's happening with these comments now is that as people are describing their experience, what's already going on is that we're likewise exploring the third foundation of mindfulness. Okay, there's four foundations. One is mindfulness of breathing in the body. The second is mindfulness of the mind's tendency to judge all sensory input as being pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. In the Buddhist psychology, Buddhist way of thinking of things, the mind itself is also a sense organ. It's a sense organ that both transmits and receives. Okay. So the third foundation of mindfulness is what's called mindfulness of sankharas, which is a term that's variously translated. I think the most common one I see is mental factors, but basically what it's trying to get at is the sum total of all of our memories from the time we were conceived, of all everything that happened to us, whether it was pleasant or unpleasant or neutral. And that can be things that happen to us physically. It can be things that happen to us that had an emotional impact. Okay. The reason the mind soaks up all of these things like a sponge and remembers them is because it's trying to take care of us in the present moment. Okay. So if there is something very bad that happened, some kind of trauma, that memory gets encoded very deeply and very powerfully, okay? Because what the mind is trying to do is to say, that was really awful, and we don't want that to ever, ever happen to us again. And so therefore, we're gonna remember it as best we can, and we're gonna play it back over and over and over again with the hope of keeping it from happening again. For people who experience post-traumatic stress, that's what's going on. Something really, really terrible happened. It gets kind of branded onto the memory for the purpose of trying to do everything possible to make sure it doesn't happen again. So combat veterans, for instance, you know, if they hear loud noises or something like that that's at all reminiscent of having been in under fire, you know, can cause, especially when they first come back from combat, can cause reactions. You know, the pulse skyrockets and the adrenaline floods the circulatory system and whatnot, because it's remembering this time of extreme threat. The same can go for very pleasurable experiences, you know, a happy time, you know, at a teenage dance or at a grandparents' party or something like that, when everyone was happy and you were with a loved ones and people were caring for each other and there was joy in the room and whatnot. You know, I got little hits of that when I was listening to the music before I found it starting to get annoying. You know, it's just like, but it this same thing, you know. So the sankhara is this sum total of our memory banks, and it's helping us to interpret the environment in the present moment in terms of our past. So that, you know, if there's a perceived threat, to avoid it. If there's something pleasant, to bring back that pleasant memory. Okay, but what that's doing, you know, this third foundation of mindfulness, what it's doing is dredging up. There's a sensory input, and then it triggers a memory, okay? And it dredges that up. And we use all of that to create our experience in the present moment. Okay? And that is another of the ways that the Buddha said, you know, especially with the unpleasant memories, okay, the difficult ones, okay? Or whether it's juxtaposing a happy memory with your memory of everything that came afterwards, some of which was not happy at all. Okay, so it's the mind taking all of these data, you know, pulling it all together and creating our experience in the present moment. So it may be a memory of an unpleasant experience. When people are being trained to disaggregate the experience of trauma as a way of kind of detoxing or disempowering the memory, okay, the two things that you are looking at there, when the unpleasant memory comes up, one of the ways that it can affect the mind is that you are plunged back into the unhappiness, the discomfort, the fear, the anxiety, okay? You relive it again, okay? But you're experiencing that in the present moment, okay? You're sucked into the picture, you're back in the crystal. The other way to relate to that memory, however, is as it arises, is to see it as an unpleasant memory. To recognize it as a memory that's painful. Okay. In that moment, when instead of reliving the memory comes up and you say, oh wow, that was a bummer, you know, that was unfortunate. That is a moment of mindfulness. And in fact, part of the training in mindfulness meditation, as these various things come up, is to train the mind, the observing mind, when one of these memories arises, is to label it as painful, label it as disturbing. Okay. In so doing, and seeing it for what it does and labeling it, each time you can do that, you gradually disempower the memory. Okay. And in some cases when you're doing that, when you're able to disaggregate, to disengage the facts of the memory from the emotion that's attached to the memory, oftentimes what happens is that the factual memory becomes more clear. You're able to see more aspects of it than you could before because it doesn't have quite the emotional charge. A Dzogchen teacher, a Tibetan teacher named Sokni Rinpoche says that it's very much like, you know, he talks, you know, a lot of devotees of Tibetan Buddhism, they wear something called a mala, which is beads on a string. And they'll use it to aid in chanting practice. And he said, it's a little bit like loosening the strings on a mala. When the beads are tied tightly together, it seems like it's a solid entity. But as you loosen the thread that holds them together, spaces begin to appear between them. Okay. So when we're practicing mindfulness and an unpleasant memory comes up, if you can get to the point where you can distinguish the facts of the memory from the emotions that the memory arouses, okay, then you're actually renegotiating your relationship with the memory so that the memory gradually becomes less poignant and less painful. And you're also able to see more clearly why it was painful, why it hurt, why it was disturbing. Okay. And then what tends to follow after that is some sense of compassion for yourself. This is all happening within the context of mindfulness meditation. That's why we do it. Okay. That's what the Buddha meant when he said, yes, indeed, it is possible to bring the suffering to an end. Okay. Any questions about any of that? Or comments or anything? All right. Then on to the fourth noble truth, which is how to actually go about doing this. The icon here, the Dharma wheel or Dharma chakra, is described in Sanskrit and Pali. Very earliest depictions, like this one here, has a hollow hub. Okay. Has eight spokes. Okay. Has an outer rim. These eight aspects of the Eightfold Path are divided up into three categories. The first category is the meditative qualities of the Eightfold Path. And those qualities are the ones of putting forth a certain amount of effort, allowing the mind to become concentrated. And then as the mind becomes more concentrated, as you exert just the right amount of effort, then mindfulness begins to flourish, begins to develop. So those are the first three factors, the meditative factors. Effort, concentration, and mindfulness. They reinforce each other, they strengthen each other. Those are the ones that we practice when we're sitting here together. Okay. Once the mind becomes somewhat calm and concentrated, you're exerting just the right amount of effort. The Buddha used the simile of tuning a lute. You know, if the string is too loose, it won't make sound. If it's too tight, it's out of tune. It's not playable. You find just that sweet spot right in the middle. It's sometimes referred to as effortless effort. You know, when we're doing this practice, like when you're talking about, you know, Joseph being there at the monastery and having all the racket across the street, and then being aware that his mind was severely agitated and he was feeling strongly aversive to what was going on, at some point it dawned on him that that was unskillful effort. You know, that he was very attached to the idea of like hitting the first stage of enlightenment or something while he was on this retreat at this place, and it was the damn Girl Scouts across the street that were keeping that from being able to happen. Right? And so a lot of aversion built up to the environment that he was in because he wasn't able to achieve what he thought his goals ought to be. And it wasn't until quite near, you know, later on when he was there, when he realized that the true goal was equanimity, you know, was being able to be with the pleasant without attachment and with the difficult without aversion. So he finally found what he was looking for. He just didn't know that's what he was looking for, right? And he didn't know what the appropriate means was to get there because the effort was off. The effort was motivated largely by attachment, by craving for some spiritual attainment. So these three meditative factors then establish the foundation or the basis, okay, create conditions favorable for the arising of what are called the wisdom factors. And one of those wisdom factors is the ability to develop insights, okay, into all the causes and conditions that gave rise to who we are at this moment in time, okay, and all the causes and conditions that gave rise to the world being as it is at this point in time. It's called dependent origination. Being able to take in and to intuit, to understand the interactive nature of all being, okay, and how we came to be, you know, our past karma and whatnot, that caused us to be who we are at this moment in time. Okay. So we get, it's the reason it's called insight meditation. We gain insight into all the moving parts, you know, all the aspects of our consciousness that cause us from time to time to tend to fall into states of aversion or attachment or delusion. Okay. Having gained those insights, then we can also gain insight into, if, when we become aware of the degree to which the discursive mind actually creates the self at any given point in time, then we begin to gain some ability to participate in the self-creating process. In other words, the other wisdom factor is insight into who we're going to be in the next moment in time. So those two wisdom factors, the wisdom factor of insight into our past, and the wisdom factor of insight into our future. Okay. Right understanding, right view is how it's classically talked about. Okay. And then those, there's the two wisdom factors, and then there are the three factors that are the manifestation of the meditative stability and the insights, which is how we speak and act and live our lives in the outer world. So there's the inner aspect of the Eightfold Path, where we look inward and gain insight into the nature of our mind. And then there's, and ultimately come to some understanding of the emptiness of self, actually, the empty hub. And then the outer aspect, where the Dharma hits the dirt, you know, where we manifest these, the meditative capability, and we manifest the wisdom in the way we speak, and the way we act, and the way we live our lives. And so that's it. That's the Eightfold Path. And if you took that in, you should be enlightened by now. I'd be very disappointed if not. So anyone want to tell any of their enlightenment stories? Darn! Didn't take this time. Okay. We'll come back next week. I'll tell you the same thing again. We'll see if we can get further down the road. Yeah. That's the overview, right? So let's talk about it. Let's, any questions or any observations or anything you might have? It's a good time to bring them up. Please.
I just have one question back to when you were talking about the refracted light
yes.
and the crystal. How do you define consciousness?
There is one in every crowd. No. Thank you. It's a beautiful question. It's really a beautiful
Sorry.
Question. No, of course. I learned in some, you know, art appreciation class somewhere, I think that one of the hallmarks of, you know, but is it art, and that question is whether it's multi-textured, you know, whether it's susceptible to more than one form of interpretation, perhaps. So what you find in the classic texts, you know, and the transcripts, to the best of our knowledge of what the historical Buddha actually said, to all the commentaries down through the years and whatnot, you find these words being used in different ways for different purposes. Okay. One of them is consciousness of, in terms of the mind's ability to discern a sensory input, a sensory stimulus. Conscious of, aware of an odor, aware of a sound, aware of an emotion. Consciousness, little c. Consciousness, big C, is sometimes used to describe one of the functions of, or the nature of, mind with a big M. Okay. Not the discursive mind, that particular function that a mind, that the mind is under, is performing in order to conjure the self, but rather the totality of one's taking in and being part of the greater whole of the universe, but with a knowing factor being present. In other words, consciousness writ large, consciousness of the entirety of all being, consciousness of our own nature, and our natural place in the state of being. Okay. That's, you know, the Buddha at the very outset in the Greater Discourse on the Foundations of Mindfulness, when he's talking about, you know, the being mindful of mind, being mindful of what's going on in the mind, you know. He said the meditator knows when the mind is contracted, when the mind is affected by aversion, okay. And he literally talked about it. Now, I think for a lot of us, especially if we're experiencing anxiety or fear, there is this sense of the mind kind of curling up in a little ball, trying to, you know, draw in like a turtle, you know. And the Buddha said, and the meditator knows the expanded mind to be the expanded mind, you know, which is, which he described elsewhere as one's consciousness expanded beyond the discursive self. And using the Dzogchen teaching device, expanded outside the crystal, kind of re-engaging with the primordial light, the source. So that's one way of understanding sort of consciousness with the big C. Long wordy answer to a short, simple question. that's at least one take on it. Yeah. Good question. Please.
I like the definition of just plain awareness. Mm-hmm. You know, consciousness is awareness, unconsciousness is unaware. So it simplifies it in my head a lot better.
Yeah, sure, sure. Again, there are sort of multiple ways of understanding that in a way. One is awareness of the phenomenon on the material plane, and then the other is the one I was just talking about, the relationship between the wisdom factors and the worldly factors, which is awareness of the arising of choice, awareness of the ability to act out of generosity instead of greed, to act out of kindness or open-heartedness instead of aversion, the ability to act out of wisdom instead of delusion. And so it's in some ways kind of a higher level, because it's the one when it becomes apparent that you have choices, that you're free to do other than simply replicating whoever it was you were up to that point.
So that's the idea that consciousness actually holds different things.
Yeah. And that great holding vastness is sometimes, especially in the Mahayana, referred to as mind or big mind, as well as distinguished from discursive mind, which is, you know, the crystal. Okay. Well, now that we're about done, it's very quiet. So I want to thank everyone for having come here this evening, having sat through our little musical interlude, and having hung out and heard some Dharma and sharing your own as well. Very much look forward to the possibility of seeing you back here again next week for more of the same, explore some of these ideas a little more completely. So, before we go our separate ways this evening, why don't we take just another minute or two, settle back into our sitting posture, if you can. May our efforts be easeful. May our concentration be kindly generated. May our mindfulness continue to grow. May our insights continue to deepen. And may our speech, our actions, and our way of life be informed by generosity, by wisdom, and by kindness of heart. safe journey home. See you next week.